The thing that you're focusing on is thought. It's what the Buddha means when he says life. Okay? It's you over the period of your lifetime. Okay? That's what he means when he says thought. You've never looked back on that being who lived that whole life and said, oh, it's just my projection. Okay? Never happened. Up until this moment, you have always thought that if you wanted to help that being, you had to manipulate some external object. You know, if you want to be happy, you got to go to the store and get some food. If you want to be relaxed, you have to go out to Santa Cruz and take a vacation. You know, if you want to look nice, you have to exercise that body. Those are all ignorance. That's not the way you get those things. It's not the way it happens. It's only by collecting good deeds. You don't know if you go to the beach whether you're going to get sunburned or healthy, or whether you're going to get skin cancer or a nice tan. You don't know. Going to the beach is not a cause for being relaxed. Ask any parent. No. You don't know. Going to the beach is not a cause of happiness. Period. It's not. Oftentimes when you go to the beach, you get some relaxation, but not all the time. Therefore, ergo, going to the beach is not a cause of happiness. If you were happy at the beach, it wasn't going to the beach that made you happy. Because lots of people go to the beach and have a miserable time. Okay? Going to the beach is not the cause of enjoying yourself at the beach. Period. Okay? But your whole life has been acting on that premise. Your whole life has been acting on the premise that if you manipulate these outside causes and change something, you can obtain what you're looking for. It's not that. You have to work on what? Fix your projections. How do you do that? Plant new ones. How do you do that? Help other people. Practice the Dhamma. You know. If you want to have a good time at the beach, go to Vajrapani and cook a nice dinner for everybody, right, Jim? I'm hoping you get more volunteers than that. I don't think it'll work. Say Kansa. Kansa. Kansa means person. And Kamala Shila says, in this case, it refers to the person out there trying to manipulate things, coming and going, over and over. Okay? The person out there trying to manipulate his or her world, trying to fix it by external means. They don't work. If it doesn't work once out of 100 times, it's not a cause. Causes have to work all the time. If you find a real cause for happiness, it better work every time. Would you, as you walk up to an airplane, this happened to me in Russia, you know, and the stewardess is up there, doubly dear, God bless you, baby. And they say, if they got up there and said, we're not sure if the plane's going to fly today, you know, we haven't figured out the causes that make a plane fly. You know, it's 90% sure. You know, 90% sure it'll stay up in the air. We've got it almost down, you know. This makes sense. You know, just get in, strap yourself in, 90% you're going to make it to Moscow, you know. We don't quite understand why airplanes fly. That's not causation. That's not scientific. Science means replicating an experiment, you know. If you do the same thing with the same conditions, the same thing should happen again. But you can go to the beach and have a good time, or you can go to the beach and have a lousy time. So going to the beach doesn't create happiness. It's just not a cause. And it's crazy to get into a plane if they tell you it's only going to work part of the time. You know. I know. No, I know. What's keeping the plane up is not the engines and the air. Okay. It's your projection. And you're hoping that it lasts until they touch down. No, but for some people it doesn't. Some people die before it touches down. You know. Yeah. Okay, that's all for that. I'll answer a few questions if you like. By the way, Friday night from 7 to 9, we're just going to have a wrap session. So if anybody wants to come. Friday night from 7 to 9 in the Gomba. Okay, and it's not a formal teaching. We're just going to sit down and we can talk. Talk about what we had in the class so far. Just no structure. Just whatever you want to talk about. Okay. Yeah, Tuesday and Thursday. If you want to have, you have to come to Tuesday and Thursday if you can. Okay. That's at 7 to 9 each night. I'd like to put in a plug for the dinner, okay? if 20 people go, I get a free dinner. No. Nah. I mean, I've worked and lived in Dharma centers my whole life, you know, my adult life, and you're always broke, and you never make enough money, and everything's always scratching along, and really, theoretically, it is the most precious thing in the world, you know. I mean, all the United Nations should be funding all these Dharma centers, you know, out of a desire for public welfare, you know, public happiness. But people just don't recognize that. And I think almost every Dharma center, unless you have some extraordinary sponsor, you're all trying to find ways to stay afloat. And it's a very precious thing. You know, it's very easy to come here. You focus on the person teaching or something like that, and all your thoughts go towards that. And you kind of miss the fact that you're sitting on something that costs money to maintain. And, you know, you're going to go down a road that costs something to maintain. And you're pooping in a place that costs something to maintain. And you're eating off plates that cost something to maintain. And it's expensive. It's as expensive as anything else in the world. So I really encourage you to, not only to come, I mean, I would really encourage you to help Vajrapani, you know, make some kind of donation to Vajrapani, help them. It's really bad, and it feels really bad if you're trying to run a Dharma center and you can't even meet your expenses, which we're not. You know, I have a job in... with my precious boss, and so I'm lucky. I don't need anything, and I'm not asking for that. This place is really expensive to maintain, and it's a beautiful, beautiful place, and it should be treasured, and it should be cherished, and you should try to help to keep it going. So don't be shy about that. Okay, come to the dinner if you like, but either way, try to help out as much as you can. Okay. I don't think anyone here is real rich, but, you know, to the best of your ability. It's just important to keep this thing clear. Huh? When's the dinner? I don't know. Sunday night? Sunday night at 7 in Santa Cruz. Okay. Get your ticket from Amy Muir. Okay, tonight we're going to start with a little Buddhist geography lesson. You want to study Buddhist geography, yeah?
First thing I just wanted to mention, do you think that maybe to write larger?
Yeah, I'll try.
Okay.
I'll try. If you want to study Buddhist geography, you got to go to the Abhidhamma Kosha, third chapter. Starts out with presenting all the beings in the world, and including Bardos. That's where you get the good teachings on the Bardo, the real one. Then you go to the description of space, time, things like that. It's very interesting. The last part of the chapter describes how the world began and how it will end. The word for world is this. Say jikden.
Jikden.
Okay. Jik means to be destroyed. To be destroyed. Like jikje. Well, that's a different jik. Anyway. And den means... Ten means the basis, destructible basis, in Sanskrit loka. And it means the world, it means our world. Our world is called Jikden. Okay. Yeah? I don't mind to turn this one off, if you can. Or does that make it worse? where is she when we need it? Did that help? Sure, it's not from my head. Well, we're going to talk about that tonight. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
In the middle of Loka.
Anything else?
In the middle of Loka is Mount Meru, which is the highest thing in the world. So Jigten. And then the Abhidharma goes into the question, are there other Jigten? You know, are there other places where people are living? You know, planets where people are living. And then they start to talk about a thing called if you're trying to be a translator and you run across Tong Chipa, it's very frustrating because it's not in any dictionary or anything. It's in the Abhidharma. Say Tong Chipa. Tong Chipa. Tong Chipa means not only are there other planets where beings like us live, but you could define a certain system of planets called the Tong Chipa. That would be 1,000 inhabited planets. So the Abhidharma describes these galactic networks where our planet would be one part of a Tong Chipa. And you could define an area of the universe where there would be 1,000 inhabited planets. And they describe them, they're much like our planet. They're very similar. The basic characteristics are the same as our planet. So that's 1,000 inhabited Jigdens. Okay. Connected in the sense that if you want to get into it, if this Jigten is destroyed by a supernova, which is one of the ways that worlds are destroyed, this particular world will be destroyed by a supernova. Actually, the sun will become 7 times more powerful than it is now, and the planet will eventually vaporize. So where do all the sentient beings go? And there's a whole process by which beings are reborn, enter a Bardo body. Bardo bodies are not like us. They can travel at tremendous rates of speed. And they, actually, the function of a Bardo is to get to your next birthplace. That's why you take a Bardo body. So, yeah, we're connected in the sense that under certain circumstances, beings can die in this planet, enter a Bardo, and reach another planet, and then be reborn there. So, say Tong Parma. Tong Parma. Tong, by the way, is the same spelling for emptiness and 1,000. And in this case, it means 1,000. In both of these cases, it means 1,000. It does not mean empty. Okay. Same spelling, same sound, everything. Different meaning. This Tong means 1,000. What does Par mean, like in Bardo? In between. So Parma means an in between 1,000. Okay. That refers to a system made up of 1,000 Tong Chipas. 1,000 groups of 1,000 inhabited planets. And that also exists in the universe. If you cut it up a certain way, you would have 1,000 groups of 1,000 inhabited planets. 1,000,000 inhabited planets. Okay? And that would be like a second order world system. This is like a first order world system. Okay? 1,000 planets. Second order world system would be 1,000,000 planets. Inhabited planets like ours. Not just general rocks floating around in space. Okay? You can guess what that is, right? Say, Tong? Chenbo. Tong Chenbo. Chenbo means big. Tong means 1,000. This is a third order world system. 1,000 Tong Parma. 1,000,000,000 inhabited planets. Okay. And that's the largest kind of world system they describe. I mean, you can cut up the universe into Tong Chenbo. There are many Tong Chenbo. Groups of 1,000,000,000 inhabited planets. If you're in the mood, okay. Why did we get into this? At the next point in the Diamond Cutter Sutra, the Buddha asks Subhuti a question. He says, suppose you took the 7 precious things, okay? There are 7 precious substances. They are like gold, silver. They're listed in your reading for tonight, okay? Gold, silver, lapis is in there, pearl is in there, emerald is in there, other goods like that. Precious substances, and there are 7 types. And so the Buddha poses a question to Subhuti. He says, suppose you take a 1,000,000,000 planets, okay, at Tong Chenbo, And suppose you could arrange enough truckloads of diamonds and emeralds and stuff to fill the whole planet, to cover the planet. You know, somehow you've got these spaceships going and delivering precious gemstones enough to cover the whole planet of a Tong Chembo. Okay, that much precious stone. Even my boss would like it, I think. He says, and suppose that some man or woman, he says, was able to arrange that sort of a planetary, a universe of precious things and offer it to someone else. Like to offer it to Buddha or offer it to someone else. So try to imagine the good deed. So try to imagine the good karma from doing that. First he puts the Buddha's mind on that. He says, try to picture it. Try to picture this planet covered with diamonds. And a thousand planets like that, and a thousand groups of planets like that, and a thousand groups of planets like that, covered with diamonds, and then you're going to your teacher and, you know, offering them. Going to someone and offering them. Okay. Then he says, consider the act of reading one verse from the Diamond Cutter Sutra, or reciting it, or memorizing it, or teaching it to someone else. He says, which would be more good karma? Which would be more important? Which would be more good karma? And and then he says to Subhuti that the second one would be much more good karma. Okay. Much more powerful to read one verse of this sutra than to make that offering. Okay. That's, the Buddha says that. Okay. And it's very important to think of why. Right. And it's true. It's not an exaggeration. Okay. It's important to think why. If you do an act with the knowledge expressed in this sutra, you know, with a knowledge of emptiness, with an understanding of emptiness, let's say you do the first perfection, which is what? Perform the act, an act of giving. Understanding emptiness. It acts as a direct jet, you know, to get to enlightenment. It then acts as a direct means of getting to enlightenment. Okay. If you can do the smallest act of giving, like giving a piece of bread to a bird, one of these Vajrapani blue jays with the funny hair. I like it because it makes mine look good. Or if you did that with an understanding of emptiness, well, that would act as a direct cause for your enlightenment. Whereas giving all of those planets full of jewels without an understanding of emptiness would not. We wouldn't act in the same way. Won't function in the same way. And here we get into the meaning of paramita. Okay. Say parutu chimba. Parutu chimba. Paro means to the other side, to the far side. Okay, to the other side. Tu means to. T-O. To the other side. And chimba means gone. Gone to the other side. Param means other side. Param means to the other side. And itta means gone. Okay, param itta. Right. Paramita. Okay. That's a parotu chimba. And these are the perfections. Okay, we translate it as perfections. Six perfections. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the idea of perfection. A perfection. What does perfection mean? Okay. When you or I perform an act of giving, is that the perfection of giving? A huge debate about it, okay? I mean, we're going to spend a little time on that, okay? When you and I give something to somebody, is that the perfection of giving? And under what circumstances does it become the perfection of giving? And what's the difference between plain old giving and the perfection of giving? Okay? We'll start out like this. Let me ask you, even if a bodhisattva who has perceived emptiness directly, who is not yet a Buddha, gives some kind of, performs some kind of act of giving, is that perfect? No. Okay. They ain't there yet. They aren't paro to Shiva. They haven't gone to the other side yet. Okay? It's a contradiction of terms to say that even that high bodhisattva, Arya, is doing anything called a perfection. Perfection means perfect, and only one thing is perfect. What's that? A Buddha. Jagni Pangbe Chir. Because they have abandoned the two obstacles. Okay? In their entirety. They've eliminated all of the negativities that you can eliminate, and they know all objects. They perceive all objects. They from both points of view, they are perfect. So really, the only person who can do a Parojachimba is a Buddha. Okay. So, when can you call something a paramita, and when do you not call something a paramita? This is the trick. You change this last part here. Say, paro tu chin, je. Paro tu chin, je. Okay. Je means makes you. Makes you what? Get to the other side. Okay. Makes you perfect. Paro tu chin, je. And now we can have a debate. Okay. Let's pick on this dude here. Okay. That would be a typical debate. Is every kind of perfection a paratachinje? Okay. Does every act which we call a perfection get you to perfection? Because this is now we're proposing as a definition, the real definition of perfection. We're proposing this as the real meaning of a perfection, and the Buddha does so in a sutra. This is from a sutra. He says, when I say perfection of giving, I'm talking about giving which gets you to perfection. Okay? I'm not talking about perfection. How can you be perfect before you're Buddha? So when I say param ita, what I'm talking about is param tu chin je. Something which gets you to perfection. Okay? A getter to perfection. Which applies to it. All perfections or not? That was my question. Which means, you know, is every perfection in the world a paro to chin che? Am I in the book? Which means, are you saying that something can be a perfection and not be getting you to perfection? In the book?
Do you think, duh?
Yeah. He said, right. Show me. Take a drink first, stall. In the monastery, they say, huh? Didn't hear you. while they're thinking of an answer. Sure. Now, you gotta show me something that's a perfection, but which is not getting you to perfection. Is there any such thing? Yeah. Ah, nice. Did you cheat? I don't know. Maybe. Did we plant her? No. Yeah. Yeah. Para stands for paro. This is Sanskrit. Para is Sanskrit. And it corresponds to paro, which means the far side, the other side. The n represents the second grammar case, locative, and it means tu, which means tio, to. And then ita is the past tense of the verb to go in Sanskrit. And that's chin in Tibetan, chimba. Yeah, but not Gary Larson. Okay. And sin means finished. Okay. So really, you can divide all perfections into two. Okay. Paro to chin che, and paro to chin sin. Okay. So all paro to chin plus all perfections are either paro to chin che, getting you to perfection, which is most of them. Or paro tu chin sin, which is the sixth paramita in the mindstream of Buddha, because he's already there. Okay. But the Buddha said, now I have to pull out this. You can't do this in the debate ground, but you know, I thought it'd be cool if you just repeat it, okay? It's a very holy scripture. Mulo Migbu Meba Shawa Taktik Nam Lamyang Mishe Tongjer Jupar Kalangyur Sharabmena Nigme Paru Chingandi Migbu Mepe Chanju Repar Nimayin Kangzai Sharab Kini Raptu Sinkirpa Dete Migne Gyuching Dei Ming Popo. Okay, this is from the shorter Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. It's called Dupa. Okay, this is a direct quotation from by the Buddha himself. Okay, so the person who said there's two kinds of paramitas also said the following, and I'll translate it for you. Mulo Mipu Mapa means blind people who don't have eyeballs. Okay, blind people without eyeballs. Mulo Mipu Mapa. Shiawa means 10 million. Taktik, where's Clinton? We figured it out the other day. What was that? 11 zeros, whatever that is. I don't know. Shiawa Taktik is something like a trillion trillion, okay? Trillion trillion people without eyeballs who are blind. Lamyang Mishe. Lamyang Mishe means they could never find the road. Tongyur Jupa Kalagyur. Much less the destination, the city of destination. So I mean, you got 10 million blind people, a trillion trillion blind people wandering around. They couldn't really locate the highway to San Francisco, much less get there. Okay. Sharabmena, if you don't have the perfection of wisdom, which is which number? Number six. Mena paro chingani, if you don't have the sixth perfection, which is wisdom, then the first five perfections, nipu mepe, are eyeballless. They don't have any eyes. Chanju repa nipa min. They cannot get you to Buddhahood. Chanju repa nipa min. They ain't paro chinje. They're not paro chinsin, obviously. They're not got already to the perfection. But what the Buddha is saying here is, you can't even call them getting you to perfection. Okay. And then he goes on. Kangzai Sherab Kini Raptu Singyupa. If you were able to get wisdom, they said, well then, Mikne, you would have found your eyes. Gyurching De Ming Topo. And then you could call them perfection. Okay? So what he's saying is that unless you have the perfection of wisdom, which means unless you are performing the act of giving, for example, with a knowledge of emptiness, you can't call them perfection. Okay? You can't call them perfection. Yeah.
How do you get perfection wisdom without being able to practice?
Ah, we'll talk about it. It's a good question. He says, well, how are you going to get to perfection wisdom if you can't practice the other five? Don't the first five cause number six, he says. Yeah. Dupa, which is it's called Dupa, which is the briefer Prajnaparamita Sutra. Okay, yeah. Intellectual or direct perception of emptiness, but mainly direct perception of emptiness. Okay, which is mainly what the sixth perfection is. But we'll talk about that in the sixth class. Okay, yeah. Right. No, he doesn't say that. He says you can't call it paratitinche. Okay. Okay. But what he means is it's not paratitinche. Okay. It is not paratitinche, which means it's not getting you to Buddhahood either. It's not only not gone to Buddhahood, but if you're not performing the act of giving with an understanding of emptiness, with perfection number six, the Buddha says, Ming Ma Topo. You can't call them getting you to Buddhahood. They are not getting you to Buddhahood. Does that mean, I ask you, that anything we do, any act of giving that we do, we can't call the perfection of giving? Good. Good answer, okay. But as we know, it's not always literal. Okay. And then the scriptures debate, this is the kind of thing we do in the monastery for 4 hours at night, 5 hours. The point is this. If a perfection, especially one of the first five, is performed without an understanding of emptiness, you can't call it a perfection. In the sense of being part of the Chinche, in the sense of getting you to perfection, it's not a direct path to perfection. It's not working that way. Okay. It obviously can't be called a perfection in the sense of Parotachin sin, because it's not already got to perfection. Is there any other kind of perfection? Then they say, there are. Okay. And they say, we can call the activity that you and I do, hoping to reach Buddhahood, Paramita. We can. Okay. Even though they are not Parotachin say, nor Parotachin sin. They're not getting you to Buddhahood directly, and they're not gone to Buddhahood and being there either. Yeah, that's the point. Okay, we can call them perfections if you do them with the intention of reaching Buddhahood for other people. You know, even a wimpy intention. Okay, even if you think, I'm going to give this bread to this bird, and I hope he becomes my disciple in the future, and I pull him with me as I walk through the door of ultimate nirvana, you know, which is really the way we're supposed to give bread to a bird, okay? It takes a little longer. But if you're thinking that as you give the bread to the bird, it's paramita. It is the perfection of giving. Okay? It doesn't deserve the name of Parotachin Che. Okay? If you're not doing it with wisdom. Okay? It doesn't deserve that name, says the Buddha himself. But on the basis of it being similar to the perfection of giving, to the real perfection of giving, okay, you can call it a perfection. It is a perfection. It is the perfection of giving. As long as in the back of your mind somewhere, I'm doing this so that I can reach enlightenment for the sake of this bird or whatever. Okay.
The other day you were talking about the one collection. It was the first four, first three perfections and some.
Three and a half.
And some joy.
I said mainly. Okay, in a debate ground, you'd get slaughtered if you didn't say mainly. Okay, mainly gets you out of a lot of problems. Mostly.
And some of the effort and the wisdom one was the meditation and wisdom and some of the effort.
Yeah.
Well, how does that statement go back with what you're saying now?
We're going to talk about it. We'll get there. So really now you have three paramitas, don't you? You have the one that gets you there. You have the one of being there. And you have the one that's kind of like a paramita, so let's call it a paramita. Because at least you have the intention to reach enlightenment for others. Okay. And on that basis, we can call what you and I do the paramita of giving, for example. Yeah.
When you talk about doing this with emptiness in mind, does this mean it doesn't work unless you have already seen the correct perception
good,
of this?
Good,
does
it
mean what if you
it's a good question.
What if you're just aware of it,
of
emptiness, and you say, I'm giving this bird food, although when I really look at this bird, I don't know, there's no bird dipping off
it. It's an excellent question. Let's go straight there. We'll go straight to the answer. It is a perfect question at this point. There's always a couple of emanations in the audience who ask the right question at the right time. Say, Korsum Mimikpa. Korsum Mimikpa. This is to answer the question of what does it mean to perform an act of giving while understanding the emptiness of it. Okay? And does it require that you have understood emptiness, perceived emptiness directly? Or, for example, could you just have an intellectual understanding of emptiness? And how much does it have to be in the forefront of your mind? if it's just an intellectual understanding, for it to be part of the chin jay, getting you to perfection. Okay. Kor always means a circle of some kind, like samsara is what in Tibetan? Korwa. Okay, to circle the Vajrapani Gomba is to korwa. A coin in Tibetan is called gormo. So kor has these meanings of circle. In this case, it means the three spheres or the three elements. Okay, we'll talk about what it means. And you maybe can give me a better word. Okay, maybe component is a better word. Okay, let's say component. Okay, kor means component. All right. Sum, you know, coin jo sum. Three. Okay, sum means three. Nimikpa means not to see them. Not seeing the three components. Okay. If you can perform an act of giving without seeing the three components, then you're doing it with an understanding of emptiness. Okay. Well, what's that mean? Okay. The first of the course, by the way, there's different ways of listing them. I'm going to give you the way, I'll show you the two ways. Okay. You can say that the first one is the gift. Okay, the gift that you give. In the case of the bird, piece of bread. Okay, my Lama always insists that we break it up into small pieces. He says, don't make them sick. The second core, the second component in the act of giving is the recipient, the person who is receiving the bread. Okay. And then thirdly, the act of giving itself. Some scriptures, I believe the auto commentary to the Madhyamika Avatara that I looked up today in the computer, list it as they leave out number three and they put what you think naturally, the giver. Okay. So you see it's listed both ways. Okay. What does it mean not to see them? Are you supposed to close your eyes when you give that bread to that bird, you know? it's kind of dangerous up on that porch, you know? That would be one way of mimikpa. But the ultimate meaning of mimikpa here is, by the way, if you do the Tsongkhapa prayer, how does it start out? This is the same idea. Exactly the same idea. Migme and mimikpa are the same thing. It means you do not perceive those three components as being self-existent. Okay? As you perform the act of giving, you do not imagine that those three things are self-existent. Okay. Let me ask you a question, and this answers your question, which was a really good question. Do you have to be perceiving directly the emptiness of these three things while you perform the act of giving? You can't. Good answer. Okay, impossible. You definitely fall off the course. Impossible. Okay, just impossible. You can't do it. You cannot perceive emptiness directly unless your sense consciousness was shut down a long time before. I mean, you're not only not focusing on sense consciousnesses, you can't. You can't even think of a normal object. If you did, you'd pop out of it. Because your mind is on ultimate reality. And there's only one ultimate reality, and that's emptiness. Every other kind of object that you've ever experienced cannot present itself to your mind at that moment. Impossible. So it doesn't refer to perceiving directly the emptiness of those three things all at once. And by the way, you've heard stories of people perceiving emptiness as they chop wood or things like that. It's not referring to that. Okay, it's impossible. You must be on the first samdhen level. You must be in the preparatory stage, and it must be the one called mijogme. You must be in deep sitting, sense consciousness shut down, mind consciousness shut down to normal objects. Meditation. You must be in that. It is possible and likely that at the final moment of the path of preparation, which happens just before, maybe an hour before, you do perceive the truth of dependent origination. You know, you finally catch yourself mistaking that mental projection for a real object. And that can happen chopping wood or something like that. But not the perception of emptiness, not the direct perception of emptiness. It must be done in deep meditation. And I always say, and I repeat it, if you never learn to get into that deep meditation, you're guaranteed one. You won't see emptiness directly. So if you want to make sure that you don't get out of samsara in this life, and by the way, that your tantric practice never works right, job, or what you're going to have for breakfast, and sleep a little longer, squeeze that 45 minutes down to 15, and you'll never see emptiness directly, and your tantric practice never works either. Any other questions? No. Okay. That's Kosa Mimikva. Now, what does that mean? You know, as I give the bread, what am I supposed to think? What am I supposed to be thinking? You know, what does it mean not to see the bread as self-existent? You know, does it help to think this bread was made by Jim this morning? You know, it has causes and conditions. You know, here. You know, do you guess that would help a lot? Or this bread is made up of calcium atoms, iron atoms. It's got a little bit of carbon in it. It's a sum of its parts. You know, I mean, you never get to work. You know? And by the way, those are the two lower interpretations of dependent origination. Those are the two more. By the way, if you want to check that out, that was taught very succinctly by Pabongka Rinpoche. Okay, it's in the book on the principal teachings of Buddhism. Okay, I'll try to get the page number for you, and I can show you the Tibetan if you want to see the Tibetan. But he divides the four classic schools of India into those who thought that dependent origination meant this piece of bread came from Jim this morning, from its causes, or those who thought that dependent origination meant this bread depends on its calcium atoms, its iron atoms, and etc. And the highest school, which says what? This bread depends on my perceiving certain indications of bread, square, brown, tasty, synthesizing them in my mind into a mental image and calling that bread. And there's no bread out there. Okay? There is no bread out there. The bread cannot exist out there on its own. Impossible. That's its dependent origination. Okay. It is the synthesis of, in my mind, has a tendency to synthesize this. You can't see a piece of bread. What are you kidding me? How can you see a piece of bread without looking at the corner in the middle? And when you're looking at the corner in the middle, how can you be seeing a piece of bread? It's impossible what you're doing. You cannot be seeing a piece of bread out there. It's impossible. What you're seeing is indications. You have like four or five clues because your eye went ding, 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 ding. Your eyes are always going ding, 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 ding. It's picking out like four clues of bread, and it says bread. You never see the back of the bread, right? But you're always imagining that it's there. I mean, that's significant. You never see the back of anybody unless they turn around, you know. But you assume it's, you know, your mind is filling it in. You imagine this body. All you're seeing is a couple of flat surfaces, you know. So you're picking up some clues, your mind is synthesizing it into a mental image, and then the mind is saying, bread. And then you're mistaking that for an external object. What's the point? So big deal. Who cares if it's a mental image with a name on it, or if it's a piece of bread that the bird is going to eat out there, the way I always thought it was. What's the difference? Who cares? They work the same. They do work the same, by the way. I mean, if the first existed, it would work the same. What's the point? What's the point of thinking of the bread as? Who cares if the bread's in your mind or out there on the deck there? He might pick your brains anyway. The point is this: if the bread is pleasant to you, it's the result of the good. What is? Why are you synthesizing it that way? No. What is it in your mind that makes it a piece of bread that in the mind of some other being might not... By the way, according to Madhyamika, if a yidak is in the area, preta, hungry ghost, they see a stone. Or if they see a piece of bread, the minute they touch it, it burns their hand. So, why do you see it as bread? And why does the preta see it as something? Yeah. It's some kind of a... That's the whole point. I mean, if the bread is something good, and you're giving a good thing to a bird, you must see it as a result of your good karma. Then, what will it make you do? If you reflect on the causes of it that way, you'll definitely collect more merit. Okay? With knowledge, with wisdom. What's the ultimate result of acting that way? Buddhahood. Is that part of the chin? Say, now you got a perfection. Now the Buddha can say, oh, now you can call that a perfection. Because that's acting directly to get you to enlightenment. Now you're giving with wisdom. Now it's part of the chin che. Now it's pushing you to enlightenment. If you give the piece of bread without thinking that way, what happens? You will get a pleasant result from it in the future. Somebody will give you several loaves of bread. You know? That's about it. While you eat them, you'll be getting older. Your body will be wrinkling a little more. I mean, it's not real. It is Gyurve Dunya. It's suffering number two in the disguise of something nice. It's just eating bread as you get old and suffer more. It tastes good.
Okay. Is there much of a difference then between doing like an act of giving with the understanding of karma?
Good, it's an excellent question. It's an excellent question. She said, how about, and I always tell people it's like this, you know, like if you go to, if you had grown up a Buddhist, thank God we didn't, you know, because we'd probably be doing something else. Anyway. What's the difference between that and doing the act of giving, keeping the laws of karma in mind, okay? Because it seems to be not so much different. Okay, and this is the point. There's a whole bunch of Sabudis in this audience. I don't know. Say, Jigdenbe. Lam. Jigdenbe. Lam. Jigden means what? World. Jigdenba makes it an adjective. Worldly. Lam. Path. Okay? The path of the world. The worldly path. Path, yeah. P-A-T-H. If you perform an act of giving, let's say you grow up in Sri Lanka, and your parents say, you are going to have a future life from the time you're a little kid, so you believe it. As Kedubjay says about most people in Tibet, but they don't have the slightest clue why they believe it. I mean, even if you grow up in Tibet, and you believe in future lives from your childhood, You have no idea why there should be future lives anyway. I mean, most Tibetans, even in Kedubjay's time, disciple of Tsongkhapa, he said most Tibetans nowadays, they can't give you the slightest shred of evidence why there should be a future life. They just believe in it. Okay. And if you believe in the laws of karma for the same reason, you know, your parents, since the time you're a little kid, said, give food to the birds, you'll always have enough to eat, you know. People in India are starving. I mean, I'm talking Sri Lanka, okay? Then you will believe in the laws of karma, and you will perform acts of giving out of it's really out of dumb faith, blind faith. Your parents said it, so it's okay. If you give food to this bird, you're going to get food in the future. That's called, in the Abhidharma system, Jigdenbe Lam, the path of the world. It's doing good deeds, and not really understanding why. And they're not strong. And they're not a part of the chinche. Okay. I can say they're not a part of the chinche. Okay. All right, one more word and then we'll take a break. Okay. Jigdenle Debe Lam. Jigdenle Debe Lam. Jigden means? Yeah. Len Depa means transcended. Transcended. Gone beyond. Lam means path. the path of transcending the world, the path which takes you out of the world. Okay. By the way, Jikten always refers to the samsaric world.
Okay.
To the suffering world. This is to perform an act of giving with an understanding of emptiness, as opposed to performing an act of giving with a simple belief in karma. Okay? The second one does not get you out of the world in the sense of getting you out of samsara. The first one does. Okay? If you perform an act of giving, understanding emptiness, rather than with some vague belief in the laws of karma, that's Pāvata Cinche. That takes you out. That gets you to the other shore. So you have to draw a distinction between when you're standing there and you're giving the food to the bird and thinking, I hope this has... I'm doing this because I'll get lots of bread back in the future. This is the law of karma. Or even thinking, I hope this gets me to enlightenment. The second one, by the way, would be a paramita, right? A plain old paramita. Not a paramita cinche. Okay? You could call it a paramita, says the Buddha. Okay? He's a sobo. You could call it a paramita. If you gave the food to the bird thinking, I hope we get to enlightenment this way. But ultimately, for it to be getting you to perfection, paramita cinche, you have to be thinking, this bread is empty. And then your mind says, and I can tell you from experience, so what? You know, my boss is screaming in my face. I say, Michael Roach said, empty, think empty, empty. You know, and he's still screaming in my face. You know, and I'm like, so what am I supposed to remember next, you know? And what will your next thought be? You know, I mean, empty of what? Empty of anything independent of my projection. But where are the projections coming from? I yelled at some guy in the past. Whoops. You know, that will immediately shut down your reaction. Immediately. I mean, there's a very interesting thing called nyembo. Say nyembo.
Nyembo.
Nyembo means antidote. Keeping your mind on the thought that he's empty and this is my projection and I'm having it because I yelled at something, and a nyomo, a klesha, a mental affliction, cannot coexist in the same skull at the same moment. Totally impossible.
How does that work with what you said before? I heard you say before that when you're in the heat of projection, that you can't...
Well, we'll talk about it. But catch that. Catch that.
But it seems like they can, because it seems to me in the midst of being angry with somebody, I'm very well aware of that, you know, just what you're talking about. At the same time, I'm aware of what I'm doing is completely unjustified. I'm like, so what? I'm doing it anyway.
But if you... By the way, the definition...
Well, it's unjustified on the basis.
Yeah.
Even with looking at it like that, like, yeah. I yelled at somebody before, that's why they... Or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
I did something... They're doing it to me, but so what? I'm still angry anyway.
Okay, I'll answer that.
Things seem to be there together.
Yeah. We'll talk about it. So I'll repeat and then I'll clarify according to that question. It's impossible in one moment. That's the trick, okay? It's impossible in one moment to be focusing on his emptiness and reflecting on the fact that he's a projection and he came from yelling at someone in the past, and at the same moment to feel the desire to yell back. It's impossible. That's why you can reach nirvana by meditating on emptiness. That's exactly why. You know, the longer you can stretch out that, and it says lekpa sharwa in the definition of an antidote, of a nyembo. Lekpa sharwa. Clinton, what's lekpa sharwa mean? Lekpa. Lekpa. Clearly. If the definition has that little word in there, clearly, meaning your awareness of its emptiness has to be sharwa. Sharwa means appearing in your mind with intensity. Okay? And then it acts as an antidote. Okay? Just a dim thought or a slight reflection, oh, he's empty. God damn it, man. That doesn't work. It won't work. Lekvashara. Lekvashara means an intense understanding of his emptiness. A strong, clear, you know, he's empty. I got here because I yelled at somebody in the past. That thought cannot stay in the same realm as the desire to yell back at him. And that's the only way you can remove mental affliction. That is the only ultimate antidote for mental affliction. It's the only way to get to nirvana. That is the only kind of thought that, if you hold it in your mind strongly at that moment, will destroy your mental affliction. And now we talk about, one sec, now we talk about reaction time, and we talked about the other day. It will take you, I promise, 3 minutes to do this the first time you try. 3 minutes after you've already yelled back, you'll remember this talk. You know, you'll probably already be in the bathroom or something. You know, it'll be like a few minutes later. It might even be the next night. You say, I was supposed to get that antidote in my mind, you know. And then you'll write it down in your confession book, right? And the next day, he'll come in again and open his mouth. And this time you'll be more ready, but you'll still yell back. But it'll take about 10 minutes to remember. Or 2 minutes, okay? But what I mean is, if you practice, and that's all up to you, the reaction time shorten until it becomes second nature and you don't do it anymore. And the last day that you do it, the last time you don't do it, anyway, you reach nirvana. That's nirvana. Okay, yeah, you had a question. Yeah. Yeah. Bread, which is a projection. Oh, by the way, recognize it as a projection is recognizing it's... Nah. It's dependent origination. That's recognizing it's dependent origination. Dependent origination. It's relative truth. It's relative reality. To recognize its emptiness means to think, this is not anything but my projection. Big difference. But anyway, let's start with thinking it's a projection. Yeah. No, it's a good question. It's a real question. And that refers, that goes back to the three scopes in the Lamrim teaching. You've heard of the three scopes of the three different capacities of the three different persons in the Lamrim teachings. In other words, there's three different motivations possible in the practice of Buddhism. In the first one, you're just trying to get your rear end out of the three lower realms. Okay? All you're trying to do is stay out of the three lower realms for yourself. Okay? In the second level of motivation, you're trying to keep out of all kinds of suffering, which would include this room and all of us. You're just trying to get out of that. That's called nirvana. You're just trying to reach nirvana. In the third level of motivation, which is bodhisattva motivation, you're thinking, I want to get there so I can take everybody else with me. Those are the three levels of motivation in the Lamrim. Now I debate with you, okay? Gyawa ayin. You know, when you reach motivation number three, do you reject the first two motivations? And that's the answer to your question. You know, if you have a motivation of wanting to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all other people, does that mean you are supposed to abandon the desire to keep your rear end, your own rear end, out of the three lower realms? And does it mean you're supposed to abandon the wish to reach nirvana, the permanent happiness in your own mind, yourself? No, they're not at all contradictory. They're actually built on each other. You can't get to number three without number two, and you can't get to number two without number one. Now that's really that makes it a perfection. That makes it a perfection. To say we're all going there, just get used to it. The scriptures all say, look, you got to get to that point anyway. You might as well do it now. You know, you might as well have that motivation from now. Because just thinking you'd like to feed the bird, you're just giving him Girwe Dunya. What's that? You're giving him the tenshi of Girwe Dunya. You're giving him the ultimate scriptural example of the suffering of change. You're feeding him a nice meal. Yeah. And that's the scriptural, ultimate scriptural example of the suffering of change. You are feeding him the suffering of change. He'll get hungry again. So really, the scriptures say, look, from the beginning, you might as well go on the bodhisattva track, not waste time. You know, from the beginning, as you give the bird the food thing, hey, buddy, you and me, we're going there together, you know. And I understand how, because you're empty, I'm empty, the bread is empty, and this whole incident is empty. And keeping my mind on that acts as a palpitation. Okay, one more question, we'll take a break. Yeah. It's a difficult question. First of all, as we studied the other day, a Buddha could emanate as a piece of bread. Okay. Secondly, there's a thing called Buddha nature, which is a whole class in itself. But basically, there's nothing Buddha-ish about you or me, except for the emptiness of our mind. Long story. When you become a Buddha, that same emptiness will become the Dhammakaya, and specifically the Svabhavakaya, the essence body, the emptiness of the other three bodies. Okay. So that's the only part of you right now which has any Buddha nature in it at all. It's not like, oh, let's clean off your chest and you'll be a Buddha, you know. That's a wrong idea. That is the Sagatigama, is the emptiness of your mind. So in that sense, no, the bread is not any manifestation of the Buddha. But it's interesting to say that any good deed done in the world at any time by anyone of any religious persuasion is the tinle of the Buddha, and defined as such. No. They are performing the deeds of a Buddha. That is the activity of a Buddha in the world. You know, when a Muslim helps somebody or keeps morality, which they do, have a lot of good moral codes. That is the activity of the Buddha in the world, according to all the scriptures. Very cool. Okay, we'll take a break and come back. How about 8:40, something like that? Question. Let's say you give the bread to the bird, okay, and it causes your enlightenment, all right? Eventually. Is there a connection between the two? So there is a connection. It's a cause and effect relationship. According to Buddhist philosophy, and I'm not going to get deeply into it, but there's two kinds of relationships possible in the universe. One is cause and effect, and one is a relationship of identity. Meaning, and I'm not going to, it's not the purpose tonight to get into the second one. If you want to know what it is, it's the relationship between cars and Chevrolet. Okay, once you're a Chevrolet, you're automatically a car. So cars and Chevrolets are related by identity. Specifically, Chevrolets are related to cars by a relationship called identity. Are red things and crimson things related? It's the same thing. So they're related by identity. Okay. Well, generally speaking, okay, generally speaking, the red and crimson or red and marble or whatever you want to call it, they're related. That's a long story. Yeah, that's true, deceptively. We can say that. But for a relationship to occur, two things have to be going on. The two objects have to be separate from each other. Okay? Michael can't have a relationship with Michael. Okay? I mean, obviously, the two things have to be separate. And obviously, they have to exist. Okay? I mean, you can't have a relationship with a rabbit with horns. You can't be loving your pet rabbit with horns, because they don't exist. So one of the, there has to be separateness, and there has to be existence on both sides. They both have to be existing. There's another Buddhist principle that says, by the time the result comes out, the cause is destroyed, by definition. By the time one of these oak trees around here grows up to be an oak tree, the, what do you call oak tree? An acorn. The acorn is, by definition, vanished. I debate you, Tati. So causes and so karmas and their consequences can't be related. So what you do and the consequences you get from it karmically cannot have any relation at all. Not to say she chose. Why do you say that? Because one of them doesn't exist at any given time. The karmic actions you do, like giving bread to a bird, and the karmic results you get, like in Buddhahood, cannot be related to each other. Because for a relationship to occur, there are two requirements. The two objects must be separate, and they are. Buddhahood and giving bread to a bird are separate. But they must also both exist. Of course, at the same time. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. How could you say that something's connected to something which doesn't exist? Well, then you could say anything. You could say Vajrapani Gomba is related to, you know, the fact that Lincoln lived for 100 years. I mean, you either exist or you don't exist, right? I'll give you a definition of relationship. If you remove one, the other is automatically removed. If you throw the acorn out and smash it, what happens to the oak tree? Can't grow. If you take all cars off planet Earth, what happens to Chevrolet? Now that is the definition of relationship. And there's only two possible. And I'm talking about karma and its consequences. Okay, giving the food to the bird, which we don't technically call karma. Okay, we call it the collection of merit. But I'm not going to get into that. By the time you reach enlightenment, which is the consequence of that deed, the deed is gone. How can there be a relationship between one thing which exists and another thing which doesn't exist? By the time the enlightenment comes, the giving the food to the bird is always gone. If the giving the food to the bird is around still, it means you are not yet enlightened. So how can there be a relationship? Yeah, you can.
The thing, you're just taking the word relationship away from the English understanding of relationship and putting it in a Buddhist context, so that even though it's a cause and effect relation, the cause and the effect are not related.
So could you have an effect?
They are related, but they're not in a relationship together.
Could you have an effect whose cause didn't exist?
No, there can be a dominant. Yeah, you could have an effect whose cause didn't exist, because the cause is gone and now the effect's there.
Good.
And
it's true that all effects, the causes of all effects, are always gone by the time the effect comes out. There's no such thing as a cause and effect relationship.
Well, that's the way you define a relationship. Yeah, that's true. You define it like that.
No, because the other definition of relationship is if you remove one, the other is removed. And if you remove the cause, you don't get the result either. So they are definitely related.
But you can't remove the cause because you already have the result.
Okay. That's true. Okay. Anyway, I'll give you the punchline. Usually my lama makes you wait. Sonigapa Shirdev says, in a technical sense, by the time the enlightenment has occurred, the cause is non-existent. It is past. If the giving the food to the bird is still around, then the consequence of that karma has yet to come, and therefore doesn't exist either. But, in a more general sense, there is cause and effect. And then he points to the example of time itself. Okay? Which we'll get into more a little later. But generally, if all this stuff... I'm just giving you a little taste of a couple of classes down the road, okay? Is time itself a projection? What are the parts of time? Yeah, you could say, me of 5 minutes ago, me of now, and me of 5 minutes from now. Okay. Two of those things don't exist. One doesn't exist anymore. One doesn't exist yet. And the third one is existing, or did a minute ago. But what about the experience of time? What about what we call time? Is it a projection also? Yes, it is. Okay. In a general sense. Okay. We can have a thing called Petra. And it is a projection onto those instances of Petra, which occurred from the time of her conception up to the time that she died in this life. And we called that Petra. We label that Petra. The parts are the Petra of each microsecond. We perceive some of them, because I haven't known her that long. And I conceptualize them all together. I synthesize them. And then we call it Petra over the length of her life. Okay. And then we come up with another product of a projective process. Okay. The same old three steps. What? I perceive some data. Petra of last year, Petra of this year, Petra of next year. My mind glues them together into a nice, solid Petra's life, and I call it Petra over the course of time. Okay? And that's how time itself is a projection. The perception of things changing is itself a projection. Okay? And I'll say one more thing and then let's leave it, okay? And that's the only way time could have ever occurred anyway. Time could never have been outside of that process. It doesn't make any sense. It could never have changed. Nothing could have changed if it existed from its own side. It's my projections shifting. It's nothing changing outside. If it were changing outside, if it existed outside, it would have some nature of its own, and that nature could never be gone. It would always be the same. Things can't change independent of your projections. And I'll leave it there. It's to set you up for a couple of classes from now. Okay, last thing today. Does karma and its consequences exist? Okay. And what he says is, when the action exists, then the consequence is yet to come, and in that sense doesn't exist yet. When the consequence has arrived, the karma that caused it, feeding the bird, is past and therefore non-existent. But in a general sense, as we conceptualize it, the cause, the karma and its consequence do exist. And they have a relationship.
I'm sorry.
Oh man, I can't do this three times. Okay. But in a general sense, as you conceptualize it as karma and its consequences, they exist. They both exist in a general sense now. Okay. Does Lincoln's assassination exist? Does Lincoln's assassination function at the present time? Does Lincoln's assassination affect us now?
Yes.
So you did. Is Lincoln assassinated today? Well, there's your answer. Now I got, as my lama would say, cook it. All right. Last thing tonight. There's a question about the order of the six perfections, and somebody asked it. I forget who it was. But they said, how can you get to number six if you don't get to the first five? And how can the first five be perfections if you ain't got number six? So it seems to be a catch-22. I mean, it looks like you could never have a perfection. Unless you borrowed it from somebody or something. Okay. It seems to take the first five perfections to get enough goodness to get to perfection number six. It seems to take perfection number six to qualify the first five as perfections. Okay, and then Chani Dabhashirup, and on throughout history this question has been asked, throughout the history of Buddhism. So the answer is like this. I mean, let's start with, it is true that you have to, well, you tell me, do you have to not see the three components of the act of giving in order for it to be a perfection? No. The Buddha says it doesn't qualify as a real making you perfect, but you can call it a perfection if generally you're dedicating it to enlightenment. And the next line of the scripture says, because it has some sort of similarity to a real perfection. So let's call it perfection, because at least you've dedicated it to becoming enlightened. So it is a perfection. So the first five, you could go through the six perfections in order. And technically you could not have number six until you get to number six. Okay. That's one thing to say, technically. The other fact is that as the perfections relate to the Bodhisattva Bhumis, okay, the Bodhisattva level, when do you reach? We've talked about the five paths and we've gone over them a couple of times. But there's these other 10 things called the 10 Bodhisattva levels. Okay. Bodhisattva Bhumi. When do you hit the first Bodhisattva Bhumi? Half an answer there. Huh? Who? No, it has to be Bodhisattva. Okay. If, with Bodhicitta in your heart, you see emptiness directly, you have reached the first Bodhisattva Bhumi. Like, this impossibly hard level to get to is the beginning of the Bodhisattva Bhumis, okay? And you go through those in order, okay? And they are marked by the extraordinary ability to perform those perfections. So what happens? What do you perfect during the first Bodhisattva Bhumi? It's the extraordinary practice of the perfection of giving, meaning, you know, like super perfection of giving. So in that sense, they go in order. When you're going through the Bodhisattva Bhumis, you're going through the six in order. But the Buddha said also what? You can't call the first five. You can't, they don't deserve, he said. He didn't say you can't call. Sorry, I retract that. He said, they don't deserve the name of perfection unless, the first five don't deserve the name of perfection unless you do them with the understanding of emptiness, which is number six. So that's the relationship. I'll sort of state it more succinctly, okay? You need the merit, you need the good karmic energy of the first five perfections to get to number six. Okay? You need the good karmic energy of performing the first five perfections to get to number six. You need number six for the first five perfections to be paro-tu-chin-che. Okay? To be really acting to get you to perfection. They have to be accompanied by the perfection of wisdom, perfection number six. I'll repeat it, okay? You can't get to perfection number six. You cannot have, for example, the direct perception of emptiness unless you got heavy-duty good karma from the first five perfections, okay? And the first five perfections don't deserve the name of perfections, although they can be called perfections, until they're done with the perfection of wisdom, the understanding of emptiness. And then as a sideline, when you go through the 10 Bodhisattva Bhumis, which is another story, you go through them in order. Okay. Yeah.
I'm questioning the other way, just in terms of what the way you started the class. It's a tremendous gift of giving.
Yeah. Because it's paro to chin che, and only because of that, it is learning the perfection of wisdom. That's really cool. That's exactly why it's more virtue. And I'm glad you wrapped up class so nicely. You know, if that's exactly why it's more virtue to hold in your hand the diamond colored sutra than to cover those planets with jewels and offer them to somebody. Because you're holding in your hand paro to chin che, something that can make you get to perfection, and all those other things in and of themselves don't. Yeah. There's a sideline in Chogyam Shedu's commentary where he says, you know, it's not such a big deal to hold this thing in your hand. I think it must mean that you start to grasp its meaning. But that's not what the scripture says, okay? But you can see, obviously, that, you know, you can put that scripture on a bird's head and it's not gonna be a big effect at that moment, okay? Okay, anyway, you're right in that sense, and he does acknowledge that at some point. One more point, and very serious. You know, suppose a person had seen emptiness directly, and we're trying to describe it to someone else, and talked about it for a while, and then those people come to you and say, well, you know, I really want to do it. I really do want to do it, you know. And people do that. People say that. They come to you and they say, you know, I like that. That sounds cool. I understand its benefit. I've been trying for a long time. Now, what do? I really want to do it. I really do want to do it. You know, I kind of believe it's possible, the way it's been described. I really want to do it. What should I do? You know, what should I do next? You have to collect those five perfections. You must perfect those five perfections. You have to concentrate on them first. At least with an attitude of, I hope I get enlightened, okay, so I can really help other people. Secondly, you have to study intensively and meditate. It's not enough to go to 1 week course about that subject. And your study has to be broad, and it has to be continual. Classroom hours. It's in all the scriptures. It says that. Shirab, three kinds of shirab. First one is tujungi shirab. The wisdom that comes from pure hours of hearing it over and over again. It takes that much to sink into your brain. You understand it discursively on an intellectual level right now. It is not sinking in. It takes hundreds and hundreds of hours of hearing it. And meditating on it. Tujungi shirab, samjungi shirab, gomjungi shirab. The three steps of all gaining wisdom. Classroom hours, tujungi shirab. Contemplation intellectually, samjungi shirab. Gomjungi shirab, sitting in deep meditation. You must have those three. But if I had to state the single most important cause, you know, if it were my dear wish that everyone have an experience like that, I would say Guru Yoga. Okay. You must find a Lama that fits your particular personality, okay, and your particular needs. Must find a Lama. Must get close to that Lama. Wherever that Lama is, I mean, geography doesn't matter. You know, if you ask me where's the worst place in the United States where I would ever want to live, New Jersey. Second choice, Manhattan. And I'm absolutely serious. I'm a California boy, and I was living in Arizona also, but the worst place I can imagine. But forget geography, forget your job, forget your whatever. Go be with that Lama, you know, and serve that Lama. You know, serve doesn't mean occasional fruit and a flower. You know, serve means, and I don't say this to many people. In fact, I don't think anyone's ever heard me say it in my normal classes in New York City. But I mean, give everything. You know, whatever money you have, give it to them. Normally, they'll give it back to you in about 10 seconds. Okay, and that I've never seen that not happen actually. So don't be worried. Give them everything. And just devote yourself to that. And I'm talking about schlock work too. You know, if they need a house, build them a house. If they need to be, they need meals, cook their meals. If they need laundry done, do their laundry. If you have to take care of them when they're sick, take care of them when they're sick. But the magic of that relationship and being close to that being, there is no other thing even close if you want to perceive emptiness directly. There is nothing that even approaches that karma. And lamas are hard to find. You know, lamas who are worthy of serving that way are hard to find. But that's really the, if you ask somebody who might have seen it, how did it happen, they might say, they'd probably say, Guru Yoga.